I am delighted to welcome tonight Richard Epstein, one of the liveliest, most incisive minds in the legal profession. Richard is the James Parker Hall Distinguished Service Professor at Law at the University of Chicago Law School, where he has taught since 1972. He's a member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences and a senior fellow at the Center for Clinical Medical Ethics at the University of Chicago Medical School. He is editor of the Journal of Law and Economics. He has authored several textbooks on torts, healthcare law, employment law, and constitutional rights. He's also authored numerous articles on a wide range of legal and interdisciplinary subjects. He's a graduate of Yale Law School, and we're very pleased to welcome him. Thank you, Richard.
Let everybody get their drinks, and then I will start in there. Thank you, Judith. That's what I like. I could recall the time when I got married and the instructions that I and my wife gave very solemnly to the rabbi who officiated over the ceremony. You may wed us, but you may not talk at any great length about the curriculum vitae of either the husband or the wife in this particular ceremony. And he was very efficient in his dispatch. So thank you, Judith, for what was one of the shorter and nicer, therefore, introductions that I've had. I'm supposed to talk today, I suppose, about the question of the liability of healthcare organizations. Let me make sure I'm at the right place and check out my title, just to remind you. It's called Managed Care Liability. And the question is, what is one going to say about this kind of problem? Well, the first thing one has to do is to develop a set of geopolitical instincts about an issue. And when you see something on which tempers are frayed, in which there turns out to be a tempestuous day, moment, an hour of disputes, what you have to understand is that a dispute that is this large is not going to have a small or an insignificant cause. And therefore, that the first thing that you have to do in analyzing the problem is to see if you could find out a fundamental kind of error which pervades the entire discussion and which drives most of the sub-disputes that take place within the area. The second point that one realizes, I think, in trying to figure out how to examine these subjects is that there is no public policy catastrophe of this or any other age which does not have its antecedents of parallels in some earlier age. And so what you try to do when you're figuring out what it is that makes a current situation go wrong is, in effect, to try to look back at some earlier disputes of equal bitterness and equal futility and see if you can understand what drove them in their current form. And here, let me just therefore turn the clock back about 100 or so years and try to figure out what was the major topic on the standard list of disputes in terms of, shall we say, the liability of employers or the industrial complex vis-a-vis other individuals, in this case workers. And what one discovered, in effect, that perhaps 100 years ago, the major problem that people were trying to confront was the appropriate legal regime for industrial accidents. And here one will see the two themes which constantly bring themselves back in talking about managed care liability. One of them is the theme of vicarious liability or supervisory negligence, and the second turns out to be the theme of assumption of risk or contractual freedom. And the way in which these two themes are integrated one to another will tell you a huge amount about whether or not the folks who are thinking about a problem seriously are thinking about it correctly as well. Now, just to sort of establish the groundwork, and this will work for both modern and for sort of more classical systems, a system which starts talking about vicarious liability means, roughly speaking, as follows. It's a system in which there is one individual or one organization that is held responsible for the acts of another individual or another organization solely by virtue of their relationships, even if the party that is vicariously liable has done nothing wrong in itself. And so the standard illustration is you're running a railroad and it turns out that one of your engineers runs down somebody who's a pedestrian or standing by the tracks. And the question is whether or not liability only attaches to the individual or whether it runs to the firm. And the argument which eventually was decisive in this particular case is that if you allow a firm to hide behind the misdeeds of its individual employee, they will constantly delegate out to individuals who turn out to be insolvent, and therefore you will get an overproduction of services and an overproduction of accidents in virtue of the fact that the people who can be sued will not be financially answerable for their claims in question. And so most of the 19th century judges rightly rose in indignation against this possibility of deflecting liability and said you could go through the individual worker to the firm and hold them responsible to strangers. And I don't think there is anybody today who has thought about the subject who regards this as an inappropriate legal response. The second question is, what happens if it turns out that you have two workers in a firm and one of them in the course of employment now injures another? And the issue is whether or not the same regime of vicarious liability as applied to strangers ought to carry over to vicarious liability inside the firm. And there certainly was a passionate debate over this, which went down to the question about the efficiency of market arrangements on the one hand, as opposed to the metaphors or the language of exploitation and taking advantage, industrial domination and the like. There was a strong, very strong socialist element in this debate, and in the end, the kind of the response sort of split. The classical common lawyers who were more efficiency-oriented reasoned more or less as follows. When you decide to work with a particular employee and the employer is standing there and the three of you are arranging it, you can easily organize your affairs so that there be full liability, no liability, or liability somewhere in between. And to the extent that the three of you have some kind of contractual arrangements amongst themselves, you should not upset it as so far as it applies to the dealing with liability and the incidents for loss any more than you ought to interfere with that arrangement insofar as it deals with the tenure of employment on the one hand or the applicable wage that was paid on the other. And so what you did in effect is you got a willingness on the part of some judges to keep their hands off of these kinds of an arrangement. Now, the standard critics about this situation said you can't possibly do that in the employment context, because if you did, what you would discover is that employees would simply run and hide from liability, and that you would have a situation which would replicate the worst scenario that you can imagine if you denied employer liability with respect to strangers. Now, it turns out the historical record falsifies that particular conclusion and prediction, and that one can show that there were very sophisticated contractual arrangements, particularly in the mines and on the railroads, the most dangerous form of an employment, in which the employers agreed to assume some liability, indeed more liability than the common law imposed upon them, but for a lower level of damages. And these private arrangements became the protocol for the workman's compensation situation. And I think the lesson that one learned under these kinds of situations is that the voluntary organization of these arrangements, even when you have parties of vastly different sizes, works very differently from stranger arrangements, because the company that wants to exclude liability after the fact is the company which will have a hell of a difficulty in trying to attract workers or patients before the fact. So that the issue that one always has to worry about in these cases is which model is going to apply and how. Fast forward now from this particular case to another modern case which raises the same issue in slightly different form. Talk about sexual harassment. This is not meant to be a brief for sexual harassment as a practice, but if you're trying to figure out why it is that this has become such a contentious political issue, it's the insistence on the part of the courts that an individual worker must have a right of action against the employer when a fellow employee has engaged in acts of harassment. When the appropriate response is to say, if all of them are together, you should allow them to work this thing out by contract, and to the extent that the employer has strong incentives to keep and attract workers, it will do so by giving a whole mixture of contract terms and job opportunities that minimize the risk of harassment without creating undue costs in other kinds of directions. And this inability to allow contractual correction for what turns out to be a legal judgment about the right rule of liability turns out, again, to be the source of most of our difficulties. Well, these two arrangements that I'm talking about carry over very powerfully when you start to deal with the question of liability for managed care organizations or medical providers for the injury that they've done. And let me see if I can kind of structure the thing to you again by going back and doing a little bit more legal history. Only this time we will not go back to the time when memory runneth not. The contrary, I will go back to the introduction that I had with the entire issues of the liability system when I was first thinking about this back in the mid-70s in connection with medical malpractice liability. And the article that I wrote after thinking about it a bit was just a replay of the things that I've said. What was wrong with malpractice liability in the 1970s is that the courts had figured out a regime of negligence that they thought was so wonderful, they were prepared to apply it, even though the logic of private contracting indicated that some other arrangement for dealing with medical mishaps would be superior in terms of its overall long-term sustainability. So when I started to write about this subject, I talked about medical malpractice and sort of said this is the case for contract, and indicated quite simply why it was that the current system was not going to be able to survive in and of itself at a level of high degrees of efficiency. And the explanation is very simple. If it turns out that you wish to pay people huge dollar figures at the back end for medical mishaps, which may or may not be attributable to negligence, assuming that you can draw the line between negligence and innocent mistake, somebody's going to have to fund that at the front end. And the only people who can fund that kind of liability are going to be the patients. And so therefore you have to bring the system into equilibrium, and the only way that you could do that is to raise the charges at the front in order to cover the liabilities at the back. And the moment you start to do that, you will find that there will be a withdrawal of medical services when people have decided that they'd rather not pay at the front end for services that they don't want and for protection that they don't need, and they will do without the medical care and send their money somewhere else. Now, the medical malpractice problem has not completely disappeared, but it has to some extent declined in recent years, and the question you have to ask yourself is, why is that the case? And I think the answer has very little to do with the wisdom of the law, but rather has to do with two issues which you should never underestimate in this discussion. The first of these particular issues turns out to be nothing more than good old-fashioned technology. When one starts to think about the ways in which medical liability took place in the 1970s, you would realize quite quickly that anesthesiology, relative to what it is today, was a comparatively primitive discipline. And the number of mishaps that you had because of insufficient monitoring was probably 10 or 20 times what they are today. The point is, we can now make variable injections of various kinds of anesthetics so that we don't have to make a once-and-for-all, all-or-nothing guess about the appropriate dosages, which are always calculated to make serious kinds of mistakes for a variety of technical reasons, none of which I will bore you with now. So that when you realize what is going on, in effect, if you could reduce the incidence of failure, what happens is you reduce the incidence of liability, even though there's no change whatsoever in the applicable legal rules, and that in part is what has happened. Second explanation that one finds for this particular result comes from a somewhat different source, and that's the fact that we have now changed the legal regime, or the business regime to be more accurate, under which various kinds of medical services are provided. One of the dominant features of the medical regime that one had in 1976, it was dominated by individual fee-for-service physicians. And whatever one wants to say about their skill and enterprise, one of the things that individual physicians do not have typically is access to very large databases which give you some relative information about the desirability of this kind of treatment for that kind of person under these sorts of circumstances. And one of the great advantages that you have when physician groups start to amalgamate with one another, and indeed one of the great advantages you get when managed care organizations oversee what it is that physicians do, is this data becomes available, and to the extent that it becomes available, it allows you to improve the kinds of protocols that you have. It allows you to make inspections of physicians to see that they retain their competence, notwithstanding the fact that they're moving on in age, or for whatever reason. So that by these two kinds of things, you can, I think, reduce the level of malpractice incidents, notwithstanding the fact that the legal rules may not be perfectly hospitable. The situation with managed care organization introduces a third element into this situation, which makes things almost more dangerous than they were before. To understand why these things arise, I think it's important to understand what it is that distinguishes medical care as a kind of social necessity of our times from something like education or housing. And quite clearly, the key decisive feature is that you know basically from the beginning how much you're going to have to pay in each period of your life for housing, how much you're going to have to pay for food, how much you're going to have to pay for education, so that you could either pay for it out of current earnings or out of anticipated savings or out of borrowings, one form or another. It's nice, smooth expenditures, and those are the kinds of things that people can hand privately. When you start to deal with the question of how it is that you handle medical expenditures, what people worry about is not the fact that they may have to pay $200 a year in order to see the doctor twice, or in New York City, once every 5 years at that particular rate, I suppose. But rather what they're worried about is the small probability of a high catastrophic injury, or in the alternative, they're worried about very expensive predictable costs with having to deal with the end of life. And the moment you get the low probability, high payoff type situation, one must introduce a third-party payer by way of insurance. And the simple explanation for the difficulties that we face is the moment the third party comes in, there is a serious moral hazard of overconsumption of medical resources, because the patient and the physician can form an alliance which says whenever there's a doubt, what we'll do is we'll provide more intensive services because we know that they're covered by insurance, which is an external cost to us, and yet the benefits are going to inure to us either in the form of medical payments on the one hand, or at the margin somewhat better health and security than we would otherwise have. So once you introduce this third-party dynamic, it turns out insurance companies are faced with a fateful choice. On the one hand, what they can decide to do is to simply be an open checkbook and write out their bills one way or another after the physicians start to submit them. And if they do that, what they will discover is that each patient will rejoice in the individual case, but the group of patients will be, in effect, deeply dissatisfied because the overall push on rates will, in effect, drive every one of them out. And therefore, in response to this pressure, over time, insurance companies with a passive management attitude tended to modify their structure so as to become much more aggressive in the way in which they examined and supervised medical care. And this, in fact, meant that to some extent, whether you like it or not, the payors had to get themselves involved in various kinds of decisions about medical care would or would not be provided. That is, in addition to providing various kinds of guarantees against catastrophic losses, they had to routinely monitor medical services, and this, in effect, came square up against the medical profession with its own vision of how it is autonomous medical decisions in the best interest of the patient are the only paradigm on which one can proceed. Now, anybody who's ever studied all the complications associated with medical licensing understands that the practice of medicine is not only a learned profession on the one hand, but it is also a business on the other hand. And like most businesses, what you'd love to do is to have guaranteed sources of payment and protection against competition from outside parties. Physicians are no exceptions to these particular rules. And so a lot of what is driving the particular thing with respect to managed care is some degree of consumer dissatisfaction with bad outcomes, which from time to time do happen. But much of what is driving this situation is an enormous level of physician resentment to the implicit downgrading of their services and their independent judgment by virtue of the fact that there is Big Brother from a private insurance company or a managed care organization overlooking their every kind of decision. So how does the game start to play itself out? What happens is there is this kind of strange alliance that takes place between the physician groups on the inside and the healthcare consumer organizations on the other side to essentially transform and to neuter what the managed care organizations have done. They tell us, and I think they're clearly wrong about it, is that all the cost containment functions which are so critical to the creation of managed care to begin with can be preserved, notwithstanding the transformation of the contracts in question. But I believe for the most part that this is just simply a vain delusion. That is, to the extent that you alter the overall contractual structures, you will surely change the willingness of people to enter into these kinds of arrangements. There is an elasticity with respect to medical services, just as there is an elasticity with respect to every other commodity that is supplied. Now, how do we kind of figure out what's going on here? Well, the first thing to note is that the docs still can be sued for medical malpractice. And so what they do is they argue that there's a perfect parity that's going on here, that if you could sue a doctor for medical malpractice, you could sue a healthcare provider for its version of medical malpractice, precisely because they're necessarily involved in the practice of medicine the moment they decide whether or not treatment is or is not to be given. Let me concede the first point, which is in fact that the decision by a healthcare organization to deny coverage is a quasi-medical sort of judgment, and then ask the question whether it follows that there ought to be open liability for the HMO or the MCO for what it does to parallel the kind of liability for an individual physician. And my answer to this is it's misery loves company. One ought not to treat the medical malpractice system of no contract and full tort as being an appropriate model for trying to figure out how it is you run managed care organizations. Rather, with respect to managed care organizations, you ought not to replicate the kind of mistake in question. Two wrongs, as it were, do not add up in any way, shape, or form to a right. Now, that having been said, how does the system start to play itself out? Well, here I think that it's very interesting if we start to look at a couple of developments, and let me describe to you what they are. The first one is the pattern of legislation that has been introduced at the state level in order to deal with the question of potential HMO or MCO liability to patients in ordinary consumer-type situations. And what happens is the statute is stunningly broad in its coverage. It says that every time a managed care organization fails to supply ordinary care in the way in which it deliberates on the provision of services, it could be subject to liability.
Now, all the lawyers here will know that anytime you want to create a legal rule, the question you never ask is, will a defendant be held liable under a rule? That's the wrong way to ask the question. The right way to ask the question is there a summary judgment that the defendant can get on the applicable issue of care that will avoid the expense of a lawsuit? The moment the standard for liability is one of ordinary care, the probability of having a court say, this is so clear that no jury could find otherwise, goes to the vanishing point, and it's almost zero. So that what happens is, even if you win a case, there'll be massive discovery, your key personnel will be tied up in litigation to answer questions about what it is they did and how they did it. You can spend thousands and win a lawsuit, and those thousands still have to be compensated from somewhere, and the only place that it could be compensated from is physician fees. Now, somebody would say, what's the big worry about this? After all, you could sue the doctor, you could sue the healthcare organization. One lawsuit is every bit as good as another. So don't trouble yourself in the slightest about the fact that we're just changing defendants. Now, clearly, if this argument were right, then the question would be, why the hullabaloo? Why would people be pushing so hard to create managed care liability if it only means that you pay the HMO directly, get payment from the HMO directly, instead of getting it from the organization that provides the healthcare services themselves? And the answer is they are not the same rule. And let me explain to you the way in which the game will start to work. What happens is you sue both of them. The physician will then settle out cheaply under these circumstances, because what he could then do is to provide the necessary ammunition to allow you to sue the healthcare organization by saying, hey, when I came into this thing, I really wanted to do an XYZ test, and they refused to allow me to do it, and now I have to do my sworn duty in order to make this up. So you now sue the organization, and to a plaintiff's lawyer, the last thing you want to do is to sue an individual physician who resides in the community, whose flesh and blood is the flesh and blood of his patients. It is much easier, to use the favorite expression, to send a message to some distant financial organization which has only a monetary connection to the case and really zap them with liability. So in terms of the dynamics of practice, the liability that you could get against this impersonal financial organization can be convenient multiples of the potential liability that you could ever get against a physician. And every plaintiff's lawyer and every consumer advocate know that. Now suppose it turns out that you saddle this HMO with the kinds of liabilities you're talking about. What happens next? Well, the obvious thing is that the HMO has done very little wrong and the physician has done a lot wrong. You would expect to see the HMO sue the physician for what we call indemnity or contribution. But if you look closely at the California statute, what you will discover under these circumstances is all such suits are barred, no matter how provided for by contract, on grounds of public policy. So that you cannot go around the horn and hold a physician culpable even when there's a situation of joint causation. At this point, it seems to me pretty clear what's going on in this case. What happens is the physicians love this kind of an operation because it gives them autonomy on the one hand, at least in the short run, and insulates them from the mistakes of their error after they settle this case out cheaply. So going around the horn is prohibited. Freedom of contract between physicians and healthcare organizations is banned, and this is all in the name of consumer protection. It seems to me that economic protection of the usual invidious sort is a more accurate description of what is happening here. Then let's just look a little bit further at some of the other provisions that are contained in this statute. I think you'll see the major pattern emerging in exactly the same fashion. Let us suppose that you are an individual patient and you do not like the negative decision from your organization. It is now under something known as utilization review. The proposals generally require that there be some independent quasi-judicial bodies composed of professional physicians, mind you, not fund managers who are running one of these programs, but professional physicians who are not connected in any way from the defendants, who are required as a matter of law to make an independent deliberation of whether this, that, or the other expenditure is going to be appropriate. So what happens is, on the question of patient autonomy versus physician autonomy versus institutional control, the only people who are going to decide what is going to happen are going to be other physicians. And this, again, reinforces the pattern that what's happened is that the power of management, which the contracts would have allocated more to the MCO, is going to drift back into the opposite direction. It also means, since this is now something which we don't believe in private ordering about, is something which in effect is going to be done in a very formal administrative process, because if you don't trust the people involved, what you always do is add layers of formalities, guards against bias, all sorts of judicial review to the entire system. But the same point remains as before. When you impose all of these layers of review and utilization and so forth, are you protecting patients as a class or only this particular patient against that particular physician? The answer that I give is quite simple. A firm that is trying to monitor access and utilization is the agent of those patients that are good actors and is the opponent of those which are bad actors. Just the way the landlord who throws out the lousy tenants is acting as the agent of the good tenants who don't want to endure the noise of filth that remain in the premises at question. What this system does, in effect, is it breaks down this particular system of control. And now the question that one has to ask is, if the raison d'etre of an MCO organization is a system of ex-ante cost control, which in the name of scarcity, a valid name indeed, is designed to limit the utilization of various kinds of medical resources, experimental treatments, and so forth, if you cannot provide that function, what's the purpose of having these organizations to remain? Well, I think to some extent they still serve a limited function, which is that of information dissemination and so forth. But the truth about the matter is, I think there is a rather different agenda that's at stake in these particular cases. And this could be understood if you compare what happens with respect to all the physician Bill of Rights programs when you examine the way they apply to that great MCO in the sky, the United States government, to the extent that it, through Medicare or some other system, is going to make cost allocation systems. All government agencies are exempt from the proposed standards of review. It is absolutely a clear case. In the government's agenda is all competition of private firms, their advantage is competitive innovation. The way in which we sap the private competition is to zap them with a series of restrictions that we don't have to obey. At this point, what is the rational person to do? The rational person will look around and will discover that the market has failed because the regulated firms cannot respond to the kinds of challenges that it has to face. If the market has failed under these circumstances, then the answer is we go to some alternative paradigm, and that, of course, would be one of universal services provided by government and general revenues. That's the model that's happened. So my own view about this situation is that the long-term objective of the Clinton operation is, in effect, first you hobble the medical arrangements of the various kinds of private providers, and by so doing you increase the probability that everybody in the society will now decide that some form of direct government provision is desirable. So we now have the following macabre dance of death, which I will leave you with as its final play. One of the things that's so interesting is how these various kinds of government-operated plans have functioned overseas, where in fact only the welfare of the patient is at issue with respect to the programs. And what has clearly happened in the last 2 or 3 years, and it's almost exceptional on the evidence, and here I simply refer to the fact that all the stories I'm talking about are run by the New York Times, which has always been a devout fan of various kinds of government programs. The systems are essentially in places of disintegration. The Canadian system at this particular point cannot, has not, will not be able to make the capital expenditures necessary to keep care levels up to the appropriate situation. There is an exodus of doctors to the United States where the salaries are somewhat better. The major serious treatments that Canadians suffer are often treated in such Canadian cities as Plattsburgh, Vermont, Buffalo, New York, Seattle, Washington, Detroit, Michigan, and so forth, often staffed by Canadians. The story in the New York Times put it quite simply, that under socialism what you have is queues, and you will do anything in order to beat a queue, including one poor desperate fellow who decided that since the market for veterinary medicine was not regulated, he would try to get himself into one of their machines by naming himself Fido and hoping that he could get the treatment through a dog hospital. This is not a joke. This is exactly what happened under those circumstances. And for those of us who remember the gasoline shortages of the 1970s and so forth, basically the only proposition you need to know is that if you regulate prices and keep them below market levels, you're going to have a disruption which will usually manifest itself in the form of a queue. The Canadian system, once it becomes nationalized, essentially works on a capitation basis. If you cannot raise the taxes, then what you have to do is to squeeze out the utilization and cut down on capital expenditures. So for those of you who want to know why it is that that system managed to work tolerably well until the last 4 or 5 years, the answer is it was only in the last 4 or 5 years that the equipment that they built 20 years ago or 15 years ago started to depreciate. And what these guys were doing is what all of these characters do when they run government programs. They take a $20 billion annual enterprise and they run it on cash accounting, not taking into account depreciation of their capital assets when they decide whether or not their books are balanced or not. This is a common public failure which cannot happen in a corporation situation where, in fact, shareholders are worried about future income streams and therefore will give you much better monitoring of what takes place in elsewhere. One can talk about the situation with respect to England, and it's essentially the same story, is that the system of socialist medicine there translates into a system of government-organized capitation, which means that there's a systematic underprovision of services in question. So what I think one has to do is to ask the following question. Will we be able to hobble through regulation the operation of managed health care plans so that they perform far worse than otherwise, which will drive us into the embrace of the various kinds of national health plans that have been tried elsewhere, or will the dismal performance of these health care plans in other jurisdictions come back to the American people that what they will do is demand some liberalization of the market mechanisms, recognizing that the denial of coverage in an individual case is in fact something that should be honored rather than deplored if in fact it is necessary to preserve the long-term sustainability. And that then gets me to the final irony, and here I shall stop, which is in this debate there is one constant mistake and assumption which has to be exposed in order to be, I think, counteracted, and that's the assumption that the rate of return deposits to health care is in fact extremely positive, so that we ought to invest in health care in order to improve health. I think the answer to that question is the same as it is with respect to every other kind of investment. What happens is you must first look to the issue or the rule of diminishing marginal returns to additional investment. There is no doubt that giving people a balanced diet, giving them a simple flu shot, or whatever it is that you can do through the medical care has enormous payoffs to everybody. But the moment you start going down to the bone marrow transplant, which has a 1.0 chance of success and it's going to cost you $100,000 on an 83-year-old patient, what you have to do is to recognize this is something which ought not to be undertaken because the risk-return ratio is simply completely out of sync. What you really there want to do in many ways is to improve the longevity of people before they get sick, and the way to do that is with good nutrition, healthy air, safe automobiles, decent employment, and the like. And that in many ways the worst investment in health care is in the ICU. Until one starts to understand these kinds of relationships, we will have systematic misallocation of resources as the need for heroic care driven by a professional cartel of doctors on the one hand and desperate patients on the other will be allowed to determine what our health policy is. And I think, therefore, what we have to do when we think about managed care liability and so forth is not to worry about the horror cases. Not that they're unimportant, but they are not dispositive. That can be told about any system in the way in which it operates, but rather we have to learn with a little bit of dispassion and some degree of regret to understand that the ex-ante approach, which asks, not do we want cases and treatments in this particular case, but rather is the long-term treatment that we seek sustainable over time. And if it is, then we can keep to the system. But if not, then we better change it before it's too late. Okay, thank you.
Do you think that there is any salvation, if you want to call it that, in this concept of the HMO, instead of trying to force the doctors to make decisions before the fact, rather reviewing them after the fact, and then on the basis of that information, changing the certain program?
My view about it is the choice between ex ante and ex post review is one of the single most difficult questions that any legal system or any organization has to face. That is, one of the things is if you do ex post review, you can have a practice which is fairly widespread, highly expensive. You don't correct it until it turns out you've got major financial problems. Because for one thing, if you're doing long-term treatment of an individual patient and you discover 2 years into it that it's an inefficient protocol, you may not be able to switch even if you don't start new patients the same way. And then you'll think about it and the new guy will come in and say, well, you did it for him 2 years ago, why won't you do it for me? So the answer is you cannot assume that it's a panacea. On the other hand, one of the worst things that you can do, or so it is argued, is to sort of look only at individual cases, right, and sort of decide good or bad and not take into account a large enough market basket. So you really want to do effectiveness reviews that are going to be ex post to see how the thing runs its course. The moment it becomes clear that there is no dominant solution, either one way or the other, then it becomes equally clear that the government will never have enough information to decide what the appropriate mix between the ex ante and the ex post would be. The government kind of regulation that works is something which says, here is a white line, this is a highway, do not cross it. Here is a red light, this means stop, green means go, and the moment you add orange, you're at the limits of their capabilities. And the kinds of stuff that you're talking about here, they simply don't have the ability to figure out what to do. They can't decide with respect to Medicare how to run it, even when they turn out to be the proprietor. The thought that a non-proprietary review that mandates one system over another has got to be wrong. So I think the answer is, you're surely right that they have to use some very complicated system. It would be surely correct to say that you do not want to have a dollar-for-dollar pass-through, so that every time the doc decides that the patient can't get a recovery, he's going to be enriched by one-half the dollars that is saved in that case. And certainly the patient and physician review utilization has to take a market basket in. But one of the things that we know is that these protocols inside managed care organizations in a competitive market have been changed and tinkered with on a very frequent basis. Nobody knows what the optimal situation is, so the question is, which is likely to get you the correct trajectory. Somebody who says every 5 years the government will review this issue and use a one-size-fits-all kind of approach, or whether you think that experimentation is going to work. And for those who doubt that experimentation is real, just remember 3 years ago or 4 years ago, fixed rate capitation was all the rage against amongst HMO organizations. It didn't work because of consumer resistance, and then all of a sudden PPOs became a little bit more the choice, and now no one's quite sure exactly how much discretion ought to be given to the physicians inside the plan, outside the plan, and so forth. When you get that level of heterogeneity and that level of volatility, there is no external government program that is nimble enough to keep up with the problem at hand. So I think you're right about the medical observation, but I think you'd be wrong about any implication that this is an argument in favor of regulation. Yes, sir.
At the end of your talk, you touched on some interesting ethical questions, which I don't think you quite answered.
Well,
you said if there's a 1% chance that a bone marrow transplant might help a patient live from 73 to 75, then we have to make some kind of obvious choice. The question is, what if there's a 10% chance, and what if there's a 20% chance, and what do you do if there's a 50% chance, and who makes the decision as to whether there's a 50% chance that a bone marrow transplant might extend the life of someone from 78 to 80. Now, it's a choice which might be easier for a 40-year-old to make than a 78-year-old person. And I think what the basic problem is, these are ethical questions that no system of medical care has ever been able to address. And these are ethical questions that I think have to be addressed and really can't be answered. The basic thing is, medical care is extremely expensive, good medical care is even more expensive, and in some ways it has to be rationed. And no one has solved the problem of how it should be rationed in some kind of ethical way.
The moment you say that nobody has solved the problem, then the next thing is, what makes one think that a system of government regulation will counter the solution? It would not, I mean, I'm not asking to you, I'm saying generally. What you're doing in effect is as follows. If you have to imagine that this is a blackboard, and these are the kinds of treatments that you could give, and the benefits start going down like this. And then it turns out the cost of the treatments always at some point are going to start moving up like this. We know that there's a point at which they course, and then the question is, this is an existence theorem. We believe in the general shape of this curve. We believe in the general shape of that curve. We know there are things that are obviously too far. They know that there are cases in which it's not enough. The difficulty that we have is not an ethical matter. Everybody agrees in the crossing. The difficulty that we have, quite simply, is that nobody has been able to figure out what these curves look like. What happens is, if they go down at a slope of -2, right, it's like this. They go down at a slope of -1/2, it goes like this. You ask the empiricist to tell you what the slope of the benefit curve looks like, and they give you an error term which dominates, is so broad that it dominates every rational decision that you want to make. The cost curve, same way. You don't know whether they're moving up linearly, whether they're moving up exponentially. You don't know where you're on these curves or not. If that's the point, then I think the answer is, you don't want to say that the system doesn't work because it sometimes fails. The question you have to ask is, what is the system that's going to have the greatest degree of legitimacy in terms of the population involved, so that we think that on average it's going to make fewer mistakes than some rival kind of system? This gets you back to exactly the same question that we talked about in connection with ex ante and ex post review. And what happens is, since there is no uniformity with respect to the analysis, the question is whether or not a private firm, which is going to have to continue to sell itself to the market, is going to have a better feedback mechanism than a government agency, which when it makes a mistake, knows that somebody else is going to have to pay the price. So that the issue, which starts out to be a technical question of medical care, turns out to be the Hayekian question of whether or not local knowledge could ever be captured in some kind of large government norm. And the answer to that question is no. So then the next question is, well, how responsive will these private organizations start to be? And here we run into, I think, something which I think is extremely important, which is generally denigrated by a lot of the analyses, but which nonetheless has to come back into the picture. And that's the question of what's the reputational effect of good or bad performance on the value of an individual firm. One of the things that you typically hear about today is that the world is such that the feedback mechanisms that we see with respect to medical care organizations are so weak that reputation is not a way that constrains the firm. Either it's government supervision or direct tort liability. Nothing else matters. I think the empirical evidence on that question is really quite to the contrary. If you actually start looking at firms, for example, like airlines that have the occasional crash or food companies that sell the contaminants, almost invariably the event studies show that the loss in the value of the firm dwarfs by many multiples the actual increased liability from the particular incident in question. And when you start dealing with a medical situation where you can have technology that compares notes on the web and so forth, good and bad news, I think, will travel extraordinarily fast. So my own view about this is, as the reputational markets become somewhat stronger, the case for direct government regulation becomes somewhat weaker. And I think, in effect, that the response ratios and the turnaround times on this are going to be greater for that reason. Second reason why I think they're going to be greater is, I think that most people in dealing with medical plans now believe in intermediation of one kind or another. That is, individuals feel very inadequate to decide which health plan they would want themselves. But if you've got an employer out there who has a workforce, and the workforce is caring about these medical issues, it will start to run a series of investigations to see whether or not the performance ratios that it gets from this firm are going to be satisfactory to the workforce. And if people start quitting jobs to go to other places that have better health coverage, which does happen, and people do report it, you will see some monitoring taking place. So that one of the arguments that always troubles me is the argument about consumer deficits in information assumes that no intermediaries could ever fill the gap and hold them in part, or that there's no other supply, like the Internet, for example, that can help you on these coverages. And I think when you take all of these things into account, the right question to ask is not will we get it right. The answer is we surely will not, at least if perfection is our aspiration. But what set of incentives and what set of institutions are likely to reduce the error cost of both over and under provision? And it's quite clear, you know, that the government guys are going to be wrong for two reasons. One of them is they only care about one kind of error. That is the error of underprovision. They don't really have anything in their statutes which talk about overutilization of medical care, in which you're going to allow non-treated consumers in order to sue the health plan for giving care to somebody else. It's just not part of anybody's program. And secondly, you've got what could be called charitably the dinosaur effect. That is, these organizations have such lousy feedback reactions that sure enough, by the year 2000, they'll figure out what consumer trends are in 1995, and the world will simply have fled beyond. Okay, yes, ma'am?
Non-English European medical system.
One can start to say them. What they do, in effect, is they start to look like so many socialist systems. The stated rights that you have are enormous, expansive. They're all positive in form. And then the resource constraint comes back in a covert way, so that the German system has huge entitlements and huge queues simultaneously because the budgets aren't there. As you start to go further east, the answer is you would rather be in the worst charitable hospital in the United States than to get your ordinary care that they could provide you in Murmansk, Russia. The systems are simply unspeakable in terms of what they do because they live under an illusion. If you really think that what matters, the parchment guarantees, if there are really no choices that individuals have to switch elsewhere, you get the worst of monopoly in government and propaganda simultaneously in this kind of stew, and it leads you to a terrible situation. The reason why one wants to talk about the English and the Canadian system is that
they have been generally regarded by people who studied the continental systems to be somewhat better than all of these other systems are, and they show signs of failure. Now, people start to say, well, maybe the French system's a little bit better and so forth. But again, it is a real question about whether or not that's going to be true. It's very difficult to control. For example, you have to figure out the kind of population that you have. A system that works well in Denmark may not work well in the United States because of the huge differences in size of the system and in the ethnic and the racial mix-up of all their populations and the kind of infrastructure that you have. The usual rule that you state is that informal constraints against overconsumption of a system work better in small, tight-knit communities with very powerful norms against non-consumption, and they work very badly in a large, anonymous society of people of different racial and ethnic preferences. Everyone who assumes that they have an entitlement and the fact that the harms are going to be inflicted on strangers is yet another reason why it is to move. So these comparisons are tricky, and the usual lesson that I teach from this is the same, is exactly the opposite that we get from our political leaders, which is the greater diversification of the American public by any standard that you want, whether it be immigrant populations, racial differences, religious differences, ethnic differences, geographical differences, or urban differences, means as those heterogeneities increase, the ability of one-size-fits-all government solution to work diminishes. So as you look at a population that is more fractious and more divided, the chances of having a government solution that will work will decline. And this is not meant to be a constitutional argument. It is simply meant to be a predictive argument. The greater the heterogeneity of the population, the more likely it is that large portions are going to be away from any solution you want. The greater the homogeneity of the population, you hit the peak, and it turns out that the error costs are relatively low. And so I think the answer is, if you learn from these foreign situations, you can see all sorts of trouble signs in the abstract, and when you take them over into the United States and its particular population and sentiments and size and so forth, that these errors will become, if anything, larger than they might have otherwise been. Yes, sir.
First, I want to thank you. Well, two things, two feedback loops that I see that are missing that could help, perhaps help the system get to a better solution. One is that, as an individualized, I have an employer provided health care plan, but I don't have my own health care plan, I don't have tax deductible.
Yes.
And then I would be able to shop because the point is now, I have an HMO with insurance care, but I can't have to fire them, so I want to store. And secondly, I'm always surprised that the health care providers don't itemize the cost of insurance for their care providers.
We're going to charge you $30 this month, so there's $20 of insurance you can get shot for a cost of $50. And people will begin to respond, I believe, to that kind of information. So do you have any sense of why that step hasn't been?
Yeah, I mean, let me just take the first one, which is a little bit easier. Everybody loves to have individual choice. But the problem about it systemically is if you have individual choice, you have real moral hazard and adverse selection problems that are difficult to counteract. Individuals who know about their own health problems and are feeling just fine will go for low light levels of coverage. Individuals who sense that there's something wrong with them but don't know what it is will sort of heavily invest on this. The firms understand all of this. They know that there's nothing they could do to smoke out the asymmetrical information. So what they want is group protection, because essentially the employer acts as a filter. You're not going to hire somebody as an employer if you think they've got one foot in the grave, so they think they know something about the pool which allows them to give you a lower rate. And that explains why it is, if you start looking at community rating plans and so forth, for example, in this state, the individual part of the market has been completely destroyed by the community rating system, which says you have to ignore age and pre-existing conditions in giving insurance, whereas the group market, where this is maybe 2 or 3% of the population premium for that particular group, that market has been hurt, I think, a little bit, but it essentially has survived. So I think that that's one thing. The question about itemization is much harder to answer, and I don't purport to know it. I know every time I get a hospital bill, it's itemized in detail, and I'm simply horrified that the level of cost that one sees for what I regard as routine tests. I would assume under these circumstances that the reason that you as an individual consumer don't see it is because you as an individual consumer don't have a lot of influence over the renewal and the terms of the contract. The hard question to me to ask is whether or not the employer who actually pays for all of this stuff runs some sort of benefits review to see whether or not the kinds of coverages that they get are worth the thing in question, whether the payment's in there. And until you know the answer to that question, it's not at all clear that one sees a kind of a market failure. The thing I would caution you against would be the imposition of a mandatory disclosure scheme as an effort to try to counteract this. One of the things that is commonly stated in all markets is we may not mandate terms, but we will mandate full information. But what happens is if you mandate the partial disclosure of information, it just may lead to further gaming kinds of opportunities in question, in which, for example, what happens is they disclose the charges, particular kinds of services, but they don't disclose the fact that the services that they give are going to be reduced under all the various categories. And the only way that you could really handle this and to handle this effectively, in my judgment, is in effect to have diligence by the payers rather than diligence by the government. I mean, the model here is if you have an external effect, like in the Stranger case with vicarious liability, you have to have strong government constraints to prevent these things from happening. But to the extent that you got a web of contracts, what you have to do is to find some systematic failure. And then having found that, you have to assume that the government will introduce fewer failures of its own when it tries to remedy the failures that it sees. And that's a very stringent set of conditions to meet, even though I think it's the appropriate one analytically to insist upon. Yes?
I have a footnote that sort of supports your thesis.
Hey, go right here.
The way employers will act to create a more rational system. I run an insurance company that provides workers' comp and long-term disability coverage and a service called absence management. And the idea of that service is that we have about half of the Fortune 500 companies in California. The who's who of Silicon Valley. And what these companies realize is that the cost of an absence employee in terms of productivity loss is far more important than the cost of health insurance. So they'll have an organization like ours who will actually proactively act as a kind of an ombudsman or as a manager of the process of getting people back to work quickly, you know. And that goes in the opposite direction, but we minimize, quote, healthcare costs. Because they're looking at a broader thing, which is the economic losses to the absence of key employees. And the mechanism, I mean, I can't say it's flawless, but at least it's a market force that's operating in the direction I think you'd like.
Yeah, I've actually seen that too. You know, it was mentioned in the introduction by Judy that I've been a part of the McLean Clinical Medical Ethics Center at the University of Chicago. Well, one day Mr. McLean Jr. came along and he said he wanted to figure out how he could put one of these things into place in his particular business because he had realized exactly the same conclusion that you had. And the interesting kind of discussion was how you organize it. And let me just mention one of the trade-offs that we had to talk to him about. He said, well, he would really like the personnel officer to be able to help with the medical stuff because he gets certain economies of scale. One guy knows everything. And I just looked at him and said, you know, I'm a lawyer, and I know that regulation wouldn't let you do this, and besides, I wouldn't let you do it either. If you've got an employee, you cannot expect them to come forward if the personnel record is going to get all the stuff that they need in order to get medical care. What you have to do is to create separate lines and information sinks inside the businesses in order to get people come forward with certain kinds of problems that they're going to have. And I said, what the only way you can do this is to get some guy who's run one of these programs before from the outside and figure out the extent to which this information should be used widely within the firm and which it should be gained under constrained basis in order for it to work. And that what happens when you do that is you will find that firms, in order to induce the information, will guarantee confidentiality with respect to its use. And this again goes against the usual litany that one hears is once a firm gets information, it's going to simply put it on its internal web and use it in every way, shape, or form. That's not what's going to happen. They understand that ex ante they won't get it, if ex post they misuse it, and they'll start to make the appropriate kinds of trade-offs. And I think, in effect, what has to happen is that, instead of just making this in the abstract, is that folks like you actually have to point about it in the concrete, because I have discovered over the years that any argument about how things have to work is not believed by anybody who has fundamentally different assumptions. That is, who rejects the mutual gain from trade assumption and assumes that every contract is exploitation, or that is a form of theft, and that the counterexamples always have to come from what has been done rather than what might be possible to be done. I think you could easily find those things. Let me just give you a famous kind of story about this. There were two guys who testified about some sort of increased drug regulation. One was Sam Peltzman, who's a colleague of mine at the University of Chicago, who's a very gifted empirical economist who doesn't know borscht about medical services. And then there's a fellow named William Wardell, who happened to spend a lot of time doing pharmacology, I think it was at the University of Rochester, who knew a lot about the various kinds of pharmaceuticals that were introduced to held back from the market as a function of the change in FDA regulation. So Peltzman gets up there, and what he does is he announced that demand curves are negatively sloped, cost curves are positively sloped, start to manipulate the curves, the level of research is going to be necessarily reduced. And so the question that they kept on putting him, Professor Peltzman, will you please tell us all the drugs that have not been invented by virtue of the fact that these regulations have been imposed? Well, he didn't know what to say. He says, if they haven't been invented, how can I identify them to you? And so it became one of these name that tune metaphysical questions. Wardell gets up there, he doesn't know much about economics, but he does know about pharmacology. And so what he just did is he gave the list. And he said, I can't tell you the ones that weren't invented, but I'll tell you the ones whose introduction were delayed by 3 years, 4 years, and 5 years. And he goes through propranolol and the beta blockers and this one and that one and so forth. That actually had a lot more bite with respect to it. Now, I'm an academic. I love an existence theorem. You don't have to give me any empirical estimate. My own rule about this stuff is I believe in what I call necessary history. And necessary history is if you understand the basic laws of human interaction, you can describe in a broad way what happens, even if you know nothing about the particulars or the personalities of any situation. I actually think that is a true and accurate way in which to do the law. It is essentially the divine understanding of institutions. And I think I could persuade without fail 3 people in every nation on the globe to go along with me. But if you're trying to win a political battle, the last guy you want to put forward is somebody who practices necessary history before a legislative body. You want to have a guy who knows how to generalize from anecdotes. So if you want somebody like me there, what you first do is have the anecdote guy gets on there and then said, look, you've seen the pathology, let me explain it to you. And no longer is it necessary history, now it's a convenient explanation of all that happened. And I find this extremely difficult because, as I said, what I regard as evidence comes from general theories applied to sort of abstract situations that doesn't usually meet the political test at all. And therefore, what happens is the guys like the Rosencrantz are going to have to go out into the world and tell this case, and you may even have to do it on Ted Koppel's show because you may not be able to do it before some kind of a committee. So yes, I think the battle of the anecdotes is appropriate, and that's why I told you about the workman's compensation. Workman's compensation was not a government reform. It was a private reform which was co-opted by government. Very different in terms of the history. And necessary history would tell you that they had to do it. And then you just sort of, I mean, I actually kind of invented this. And then by mistake, I was reading a case and there it was. And I became an empiricist, quite by accident. Okay, yes, another question?
One more question.
Okay, if that's what you want.
What do you think of the federal employees plan whereby in effect they get a voucher and then they shop around these fares for various alternative private programs?
Anything that's given by the federal government, you always have to wonder whether it's a waste that they're doing to compensate for wages that are below market. And so it's not at all clear that this is an efficient solution if in fact wages flowed in a greater degree of freedom than otherwise. That's the first point. Not sure that it's in fact a compensation for some other kind of real constraint. The second point about it is this. You gotta know what your population is about. The Heritage Foundation has pushed this for years, saying, let's just generate off the federal government programs in order to handle all the private cases. Well, what is your federal workforce? This is a bunch of people in their 20s and 30s and 40s, a few old codgers are hanging on past 50, right? You know, it's the youth corps in the government. You know, they have very nice risk profiles. Now take it to a Medicare population, in which it turns out you've got person after person with chronic conditions of a major proportion, known and identified in advance. You can't get anyone to invite the insurance under those circumstances unless they'll pay for it. The reason why we've never been able to convert is that Medicare is a huge cross-subsidy mill. And I don't only mean a cross-subsidy mill from the general population to the Medicare population. I mean a huge cross-subsidy mill within the Medicare population. You get guys at 66 who still pay squash on Medicare, and you get people at 89 who are on iron lung respirators, and you want to give them a voucher? Well, what's the amount of the voucher going to be? Constant for all members of that particular pool? Who are you kidding? It simply doesn't work. And, you know, every insurer will always tell you, if they know worth their salt, you got to know the composition of an underwriting pool before you do your underwriting. So if you're a GEICO and you're underwriting school teachers, you don't worry about exclusions for mountain climbing. But if it turns out you're taking on the 26-year-old set and they do all this crazy stuff, you better recognize that your policies are not going to respond to the same way, your policyholders in the same fashion. And the Heritage people just never essentially did this, but what you have to do, which is to take the Medicare population and retrofit the cost, and then figure out what the vouchers are going to have to look like to make it operational. And the variance will be probably 100-fold what they are in the workforce for the federal government. At this point, this plan is DOA. Dead on arrival.